can you ever get to a sort of 100% clarity? I think you can get pretty darn close if you're really committed to the effort. If you're really committed to creating a culture of clarity, as we've described it in the book, you can get awfully close. And there are some examples that we have in the book where we talk about the various firms who've been particularly successful in any of those three areas.
This is Real Talk, the Customer Insight Show with Jen Mancusi, a top-rated live stream and podcast in the market research and insights industry. We stream live on LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and you can listen to us on all major podcast channels and watch on dbtv.tv. Join Jen and her guests for a weekly discussion around topics that will help you understand your customers better. Real Talk is presented to you by VoxPopMe, the leader in video research for over a decade. Here's today's conversation.
Hello, insights professionals, marketers, and everyone who wants to understand their customers better. I'm your host, Jen Mancusi. To truly drive transformation through your company, it's essential to have the right culture, including being clear about what needs to be done, what customers value, and where the company can stand out from the competition. To discuss that topic, today I'm joined by Dennis Devlin and Jeff Jones, authors of Three Wise Monkeys. Welcome to the show, Dennis and Jeff.
Thank you, Jen.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Really excited to have you guys on today. I'm going to kick off the show by asking a question that I love to ask all of our guests. What does the word agile mean to you?
Okay, I'll jump in on this one. To me, agile, first of all, it does mean moving quickly, but I think there's something more important than just the idea of working as fast as you can. I kind of assume everybody always kind of works as fast as they possibly can. It really also has to do with the ability to shift directions. And what often happens with research that is very frustrating is that you make a decision of how you're going to approach it. You design your study. You know the objective you're trying to reach. And by the time you get done with the study, write the report and discuss it, certain aspects are already irrelevant. So you've got to be willing to be able to move on a dime, and that requires approaching projects in a different way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's like the speed is sort of the necessary piece to being able to get the outcome you need. It's not really just about being fast. It's you have to be fast in order to be agile.
Yeah, I mean, a perfect example is if you're doing multi-method kind of research and you're looking at, let's say you're going to look at social media, you're going to do qual, and you're going to do a quantitative study, being able to learn from each step and adjust as you're moving through that process, that gives you that agility. Because again, agility is about being able to change direction, not just moving fast. I mean, it's more of a road rally than it is a drag race.
I love that. I like the how you describe it, sort of like learning from each step and making progress as you go. Last week we were at Quirks Conference in Los Angeles, and I presented a study that we had done on the economy and inflation. And you know, the most interesting thing for me was actually all the stuff I want to research next. It wasn't necessarily what we learned, like the biggest themes. It was sort of like, hey, this is actually something that we didn't expect to come out that we need to dig a little deeper on. And for me, that's what it means to be agile, is to be able to move quickly enough to have the time to run another wave or do another type of study. Or as you mentioned, if it's multi-method, like maybe it's quant or, you know, things like that. So I love that description, that, you know, learning from each step and, you know, applying that to the next piece of work that you're going to be doing.
Yeah. And it's also a way that you can avoid what I've always called researcher's regret, which you get to the entire end of a significant piece of work and you say, oh, why didn't we ask, fill in the blank.
I love that. We're gonna have to coin that term somehow and put it out there. I love it. Let's avoid
it. I should have said TM at the end of it.
Exactly. Trademark it. Absolutely.
Great. All right. So let's talk about The culture of clarity. When you talk about a culture of clarity, what does that mean?
Well, I think it means at least three things. So when we're talking about building a culture of clarity, we're talking about making sure that you're hiring the right people to have a curious culture, employees that are curious about the customer, the competition, and the company in terms of the brand and how you talk about it in terms of brand voice. It's about, once you've hired those curious employees, allow them to perform well, right? You want to be able to promote them when they're doing, when they're being curious, and let them discover, dig deeper, train them appropriately, et cetera. And then thirdly, we want to empower them to do great work. And that in the essence, those three steps will help build that culture of clarity.
Yeah, and you know, when we talk about hiring the right kind of people, we're really talking about hiring people that are, we talk about it as being truly curious. It's not, curiosity is something you are, not something you do. And what we do is we seek to convert curiosity into clarity. So when we talk about a culture of clarity, it always starts with a high level of curiosity, asking those questions. And so the truth is, whenever I would hire someone to join a team that I was building, I would try to get at, what are you interested in? And I would hope that they would start talking about something in addition to marketing, in addition to strategy. You know, they would have some, quite frankly, some quirky kind of interests, because that shows me that they are truly at their very, you know, in their marrow, they are asking questions. And that's the kind of people you want. You want people that are almost like children and almost irritating because they're asking why so much. Why is this way? Why are the customers doing that? Why do people do this? Why do companies do this? And then, you know, when someone's just slightly irritating because they're constantly asking questions, that's the person you should hire.
Yeah. That's amazing. I'm loving this, because this is one of our company core values includes being curious. So I'm like right in line with what you guys are talking about. You know, can you talk, you just touched on it briefly, Jeff, but can you talk a little bit about, like, how do you screen for curiosity? You know, it's not something that's on someone's resume, to your point. It's not something you do, it's who you are. Like, what are some of the questions you would ask people when you're hiring them to really figure out, are they curious by nature or not?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not easy. First of all, you have to actually be very intentional. I've always loved that about Dennis, because what he always is saying, let's do this intentionally, and uses that word intentionally a lot. And I think that's true. I think businesses often go on autopilot and they do things the way they've always done them without thinking. And it's really critical when it comes to finding somebody who is curious. It's critical to have a very intentional kind of approach. A couple of things you can do. Number one, like I said, ask questions about what someone is thinking about, reading about, doing, or interested in. Those four things. Even sometimes you can learn something by saying, tell me your top three shows you're streaming right now. If they're all exactly the same, you've got a question. Is this person really curious? If all of a sudden one's a science fiction, one is a mystery, and one is a documentary, you start to get a sense this person has a broad spectrum of questions that they're asking. The other really important question, which I've always hated when I was in an interview, is that question usually at the end. So, do you have any questions for me about the company?
Yeah.
If someone says, no, everything's fine, then they may not be very curious. Or if you kind of ferret out in an interview process that they have not actually looked at your company, they haven't looked at your website, you got to ask, are they truly a curious person? How could you possibly go to an interview without having done some research and have some questions in your mind about the company? So that's the first thing you do. You're looking for people that at their heart are truly curious. They can't help it. It's the way they were built, because they're always asking these questions. And it could be about old movies. It could be about pickleball. It could be about whatever their interest is. You want to just see that broad variety of interests that someone has, because that will translate into how they approach, especially a research position.
I'd like to add to what Jeff said, Jen, and just say, really, ideally, we want to be able to hire someone who turns the interview around so that they're interviewing us as opposed to us interviewing them. Have a forum to allow that to happen, to have them asking us what, not just about the company or the position, but, you know, what does it look like working at Clarity? What is it like to work on a project here? How would I, there's so many opportunities that can present for them to show that they are truly curious. So I think in an ideal world, if we can switch the interview so that we are being interviewed instead of them being interviewed, that really shows to us that they're curious.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement with you on that. I love it when a candidate has a bunch of questions for me. I interviewed someone, I don't know, maybe a year ago for a role who I didn't ask her a single question, actually. And by the end, she was apologizing for all the questions she had. I'm like, this is the best interview I've ever conducted.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You learn so much about them when they're, let them talk. You know, I do enough talking outside of these interviews, right? I don't need to talk. So yeah. I think it's about learning about that person and really understanding them and where they're coming from and their viewpoint perspective. So yeah, turn it around and have them do most of the talking.
Yeah.
You can maybe guide the interview in such a way to allow them to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
Another thing that I've done in the past that I really liked, and it wasn't my idea, it was actually somebody that was working for me suggested this, and I thought it was brilliant, so I'm going to take credit for it because I was there when it happened. That is, we would actually have in the second round, so you have your first kind of introductory interview, and you maybe perceive this person seems to be pretty curious, and then the next thing we would do is give them a deck of four pages. Page number one would be a quantitative piece of data. Page number two would be a qualitative piece of data. Page number three would be, tell us about yourself. And I can't remember what page four was, but, and then we'd have them come in and present to us as if they're presenting a research study. Now, we weren't looking for perfection because that would be really unfair, especially if you're hiring someone straight out of college. What we were looking for is anything that would surprise us, either when they're talking about themselves or the way they articulate a qualitative insight that they picked up from the material we've given them, or even a creative way of presenting that quantitative information. So what we're really looking for wasn't so much a perfect presentation, a perfect kind of, the kind of deck that you'd put together at 2 a.m. and you're experienced and you know what you're doing, so you're able to put it together pretty effectively. We were looking for someone who, quite frankly, just surprised us with their level of asking questions and then being able to clarify what we gave them so that we know that person joining us will aid in us building a culture of curiosity.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are great tips. So you talk about a Clarity cultural cycle. What is that? And what are the benefits of understanding that?
Sure.
Well, we're at a base level. I'll let Jeff pick up on anything additional he'd like to add, but we're really talking about three different pieces. We're talking about a customer clarity, where you really understand the customer well. Competition clarity, obviously understanding the marketplace. And thirdly, company or brand clarity, where you really understand yourself as a brand and how you need to speak to those you're serving. It is cyclical. And I'll let Jeff touch on a little bit of how it kind of works.
Right. And you'll notice in our book, we have a chart of it in our book, Three Wise Monkeys. plug there. Very early in the book, we have a chart of it, and each one is connected to the next one. So if you look at the chart, it's arrows going around in a circle. Number one, understanding the customer, as Dennis said, moving on to understanding the competition, moving on then to understanding your own company or brand, and then moving back to the customer. And it's in a circle for two really important reasons. Just like you hear in a marriage, a circle is infinite with no beginning or end. So the point is that the cycle is that you keep it going all the time. It's always amazed me that rarely, except in dire situations, do we stop talking to the customer, but often we stop listening to the customer. Why is it we have agencies of record and we don't have researchers of record? It's because we believe that research is transactional, and that's a mistake. Research is actually relational. It's no different than being married. You don't like learn about your wife in the first year and never ask her a question again, or you will be divorced in 3 years. You continue to learn throughout your entire life, and that's what a company has to do. So it's first of all infinite, and secondly, it's a circle, meaning no beginning or end. So you come in at wherever the greatest need is. If there's a company that doesn't really understand who they are, really understands their customer, but isn't fully in tune with who the competition is, especially in a world where problems can be solved in a variety of ways, then you've kind of violated the circle. So we're just emphasizing that research should be infinite and research should be recursive. And we should always be thinking in that way.
I love
never
that.
Stop. Yeah. Never stop.
Yes. Never stop. Yeah, it's really interesting how you talk about research or customer understanding. Let's take research out of it, but customer understanding needs to be relational and not transactional. I think that's super interesting that, you know, keeping that pulse, that ongoing understanding and listening to customers, because people are changing all the time. Society's changing, the world is changing, your customers are changing. So that assumption that we understand who our customers are based on maybe research we did 6 months ago is going to lead us down the wrong path, or we're going to miss things that maybe create new opportunities we didn't know were there, which I think is super interesting. And that how it links up with what the competition is doing and who we are as a company is all like, yeah, just very interesting to me. I love when I talk to brands about how they have discovered some white space, right? And they always thought they were this, but through like a true empathetic listening to customers, they actually discovered, hey, people are using our products in a different way than what we intended. Let's lean into that. Let's explore that a little bit more. Like, and those are the kinds of things that you miss if you are treating it in a sort of transactional way, like you're talking about, as opposed to relational.
I have another example briefly. So sometimes we're asked to do research on that's kind of generational. And I think a lot of companies feel like they know everything there is to know about millennials, for example. The fact of the matter is that generation is still evolving over time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how they relate to products and services, how they relate to brands, that's changing as they age as a generation. To say that we know everything, or to believe that we know everything about that generation at any given point in time, is really off base. And so much like the example you just gave, Jen, I think we have to recognize that research needs to be, at least iterative, where we're continuing to go back and see what has changed so that we are on the cusp of who we're trying to reach and that we can be effective in those efforts.
Yeah, absolutely. The generational changes are so critical. And I think too, as like newer, younger generations emerge that we're trying to understand and do research on, they're actually having quite a bit of influence on millennials or Gen X. And so they're like, while we're understanding Gen Z, we need to be continuing to see how the other generations are evolving alongside them, right? Gen Z has a ton of influence. So we could go down that rabbit hole if we wanted to about generational research. But yeah, it's constantly changing. And I think it's such an important point that it needs to be iterative.
Well, you also have to think about the influences. I mean, if you think about the influences on any particular generation, first of all, you have to be careful with thinking in terms of these columns, these generational kind of columns where Gen Z is this way, Gen Alpha is this way, millennials are this way. You have to be careful because that does, as Dennis says, that changes. That's a very amorphic kind of structure. And if you read a book about one generation and then that's all the knowledge you keep holding on to, you're really in danger of not catching the changes that are made because there's several influences. Inventions or innovations, I would say, is a huge influence. Gen Z or millennials even wouldn't be the way they are without the influence of three big revolutions, the digital revolution, the social revolution, and the mobile revolution. And you have to understand those things have influenced them. So, but then that's looking back. What about those things that are coming forward? How is something like AI going to change the perspective and the attitude of the coming generations, like the generations we haven't even really started addressing yet, like Gen Alpha? You have to think in terms of what technological advances are going to be, what social advancements have happened and changes have happened, attitude shift. And I mean, my word, the attitude toward, let's say, legalization of marijuana has changed in the last 20 years, boom, like that, completely the attitude has changed, most likely because of the aging of a particular generation. And then the third one is entertainment. Entertainment vehicles that become highly viral have an effect on how the culture thinks, the values that they have. So as those things keep influencing, it is incumbent on us to do that iterative research and to keep going back. And if the bare minimum is just looking at what the social conversation is online, that at least gets you started. And that might trigger other thoughts then about doing a primary research.
This is a really good segue to, I think we're already talking about the next question I had for you guys. And that is, you know, like the assumptions that people, like what are some of the assumptions that people have about research companies are having about insights, and you know, what are some of the tactics that to fix that stuff? Is it that transactional kind of mindset? You know, what are some of the ways that companies can combat those assumptions?
Well, we're trying to change behavior, right, of our clients, and sometimes that can be, you know, sometimes that can be challenging because of all the priorities they have to respond to from leadership. Priorities change, but I think it's our responsibility in that relationship and working with our clients to help guide them to think a little differently. It's all for the benefit of their business, though. We're talking about gaining clarity. In these three different areas of customer, competition, and brand or company, because it leads to transformative success. And we're talking about gaining revenues, gaining market share, gaining profit margin. So there's a bottom line orientation that we have to remind them of every so often, that this is for the good of the business to get closer to their customer. And you know, those kinds of reminders, I think, can be very influential.
Yeah, I think another assumption, and I'm going to be a little bit sarcastic here. I think the assumption that we have to dispel is that someone thinks they're Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. And you hear from someone saying, well, you know, customers don't know what they want. I know what they want. And I've been in this business for 20 years, so I know, I can intuit what they want. The truth is somebody like Steve Jobs or the folks that developed the Aeron chair at Herman Miller, they may have a good intuitive sense of what the customer is after. And that's awesome that there are people like that. Most of us are not that people, or not those people. Most of us require a regular touch base with the consumer. So the first assumption is that you can intuit what the customer wants based on your experience. I think the second one is that research is dispensable, meaning that when budgets get tight, where are we going to cut? Why don't we cut this research study? Why in the world the very first thing we do when we think we have to cut the overall budget of an organization is stop listening to the people who matter is a mystery to me. I don't know why they do that. So that it's optional. And then I think the third is that it's temporary, you know, and I mentioned that when we were talking about the cycle, that research is a temporary thing that you do. Insights is something you do, not something you have. And so now we do our insight work, which means we are going to listen to the consumer and make some changes to our product or change our advertising or influence our advertising. Those are the three big ones that you can intuit it, that it is temporary, and that it's dispensable.
I love that. Like, insights are something you have, not something you do. It's so powerful. And also super interesting. So for those of you listening in today, you know, this is our second episode this week. We have a double week. And our other episode earlier this week with Nikki LeBois, we talked about Steve Jobs and exactly that quote of like, you know, customers don't know what they want. I know what they want. And what came up in that conversation that I'll repeat again, because it seems to be just top of mind for us this week, is that, you know, Steve Jobs didn't come up with these innovations out of nowhere. It came from a constant observation of human behavior, his own version of insights.
It's research. Yeah,
exactly. Maybe he wasn't running quantitative surveys asking people what innovation they wanted, but he was so curious, like you're talking about how people behave, that he came up with innovation. And not to say he's not a brilliant man, of course he was, but that is based on the insights that he had about human behavior, not just out of thin air, which I think is sometimes misconstrued when, you know, people say that, like, you know, customers don't know what they want. We know what they want. We know what they want because we have empathy for the problems that they're trying to solve, right? And that is insight.
Yeah. Well, I wish that we would start referring to Steve Jobs as innovator and ethnographic researcher.
Yeah.
But we always leave that part out as if somehow Steve Jobs did something. And the truth is, he's a one in a million individual. But the truth is, if you read, and I've read many of the biographies about him, he was constantly doing what an ethnographic researcher would do. He was constantly observing, constantly taking note of behavior, and most importantly, I think, constantly taking note of frustrations. Mm-hmm. We want our research results to be so optimistic and positive that sometimes we miss that people have fears, wants, and needs that have not been addressed. And in the fears, wants, and needs is an opportunity for organizations.
Yep, 100%, 100%. This is coming up a lot recently, so it's a theme. I'm glad we're talking about it. I guess my last question for you guys, like, how do you know if, or is it possible to accomplish clarity in any one of these three areas: customer clarity, competitive clarity, or company clarity? Do you ever achieve that? And how do you know?
Well, interesting that you bring that up. Jeff and I actually have developed an assessment to help determine where you are in terms of clarity in any of those three different areas. I think there's an aspect where, you know, can you ever get to a 100% clarity? I think you can get pretty darn close if you're really committed to the effort. If you're really committed to creating a culture of clarity, as we have described it in the book, you can get awfully close. And there are some examples that we have in the book where we talk about their various firms who've been particularly successful in any of those three areas, who are just so committed to understanding their customer, or to understanding their competition and their marketplace, or to understanding themselves and then conveying that in terms of the products and services that they, and how they act in the marketplace. Yeah. So I think it's possible to get mighty close if you're really, truly committed and disciplined in the effort.
However, like we said before, you can get very close to 100%, and then the target moves by some kind of change, either a new generation, a new invention, a new innovation, a new influence. And so you can never really stop, but you're always, I guess it's like, you know, as I try to be a better person, I strive toward perfection. Will I ever get there? The point actually isn't getting there. The point is actually heading there.
The journey instead of the destination.
It's about the journey instead of the destination. And the same thing is true with understanding these three C's. You know, do you ever understand fully a customer? Well, you get really close, but you never quit and you never give up. This sounds like an advertisement for Galaxy Quest. We never quit. We never give up. But as you get closer and closer, and maybe as you get closer and closer, you start to really understand the need to continue that relationship of listening, not just talking.
We lead off in the book, Jen, with the line that clarity is power. And if clarity is power, consistency is a superpower. So the meaning behind that fundamentally is that you gain so much as a business, as a researcher, as a marketer, whatever we want to, whoever we want to kind of use as context, you become powerful. You can be more successful. And if you put consistency with it, right, that never ending quest for greater clarity, you will have essentially a superpower. Mm-hmm. This is a noble pursuit.
For sure. So it's really, it's not about that one piece of learning or finding out that one insight. Like you said, it's not something you do or something you have. It's about a commitment to the process and this ongoing understanding and continuous discovery. To, you know, maybe even an acceptance of the fact that you're never going to have all the answers, and maybe sitting in that place of knowing you're never going to have the answers keeps you searching.
The most applicable reference to being truly curious is being a continuous learner. Mm-hmm. Right? You want to never stop learning. Right. About your customer, about your competition, and about your brand, because all of them evolve over time.
Amazing. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on the show today. This has been a really great conversation. I loved learning about the culture of clarity. I am like 100% behind everything you guys are doing. I think it's so important to be on this path of continuous learning and, you know, like you said, creating that culture of clarity. It's not about a destination. It's about creating that culture. So thank you so much for coming on the show. Can you tell everybody where they can find your book, Three Wise Monkeys?
Yeah. So I did want to make one last point, and that is the book is fundamentally about elevating the importance of insights. Mm-hmm. We get a bad rap, I think, a lot of times, that research is a cost. The fact of the matter is, it's a tremendous benefit to your business. It has bottom line impact, transformational success from building a culture of clarity. In terms of the book, you can get it on Amazon in both ebook format as well as in print. And it's also available as an audiobook on Audible. It is Three Wise Monkeys, How a Culture of Clarity Creates Transformative Success.
Amazing. Thank you guys again so much. Great having you on.
Thank you for having us. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for listening in. We will be back with another episode next week. We are welcoming back Emmanuel Probst, who's got a new book out and is going to talk about how to create transformative brands. We'll see you then.